From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. Pink and white blossoms as far as the eye can see. It is beautiful this time of year, but for allergy sufferers, it means misery.
Itchy eyes, sneezing, runny nose.
Some are reaching for a different kind of remedy.
Buying some local honey from Philadelphia for my allergies.
I use it on my face. I use it in my tea. You don't use honey on your face?
All the buzz about honey's superpowers is good for business, for sure.
Part of the whole reason that we've marketed our honey the way we have is because people seem to think that it helps with allergies.
But?
Well, there's no good data to demonstrate that works.
Also on the show, a geeky science app becomes a surprise smash hit overseas, and we'll meet nurses who helped integrate healthcare. First, the news. It's a million, or make that billion-dollar question, and so far, no roadmap to success.
If we're going to deliver better care at lower cost for everyone every day, we need to understand what we're doing.
It's The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez-Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Maiken Scott. The Pulse hangs out in bars and dives to the bottom of the ocean to really understand the latest treatments and research.
It wouldn't shock me if we hit 90 in April.
And we just kind of sat there for a couple seconds in silence, taking this in. Like,
I thought, there has to be a better way to do this. You know, do this, all of this.
The only data that was with the specimen was Cretaceous of New Jersey.
I call it one of the final frontiers in body odor analysis.
It is absolutely like playing Tetris.
Recognizing that the virus needed this.
These rumors were spread.
All required in relationship.
Hey, how are you? Sorry, I'm running behind schedule.
On today's show, a science toy is reborn, sticky sweet stuff doubles as medicine, and dead becomes a matter of definition. But first up, a story about data in healthcare. Actually, it's really a story about the lack of data in healthcare. This month, a rigorous randomized control trial began that'll test an approach developed by Dr. Jeff Brenner for treating very sick and very expensive patients. So Brenner is putting his own approach to the test. That's a risky thing to do. In medicine, a doctor's reputation is everything. Marketplace reporter Dan Gorenstein asks if the gamble by Dr. Brenner, who is a MacArthur genius, makes him the dumbest guy in medicine.
Driving to a big data conference a few weeks back, Brenner's Mazda compact SUV came to a full stop in the middle of a short highway entrance ramp. He shrugged, a grin playing at the corners of his mouth.
Wait for the car in front of you to go. And got it.
I can only watch as we head straight for the 50-mile-an-hour traffic down below. And we actually merge pretty seamlessly.
You have to have a little bit of faith in the universe, though. It's all going to work out.
Here's what you need to know about Dr. Jeffrey Brenner. He really likes to figure out how things work, and he's willing to go to extremes to do it. As a primary care doc in Camden, New Jersey, Brenner's developed a program that addresses one of the most pressing healthcare questions today: how to help the folks who cycle in and out of the healthcare system, the super utilizers.
We can actually take the sickest and most complicated patients, go to their bedside, go with them to their appointments, and help them for about 90 days and dramatically improve outcomes and reduce costs.
Brenner thinks his model works, but it's never been seriously tested. Really, nobody knows what works with this population, at least not for sure. A 2012 British Medical Journal article found over the last 25 years, there's been, wait for it, 6 randomized controlled trials aimed at super utilizers.
All we have are tiny pieces when what's needed is a full arsenal of evidence given the enormity of the challenge.
That's John Barron, president of the Coalition for Evidence-Based Policy. Now, to be fair, researchers admit RCTs can be tricky to set up, time-consuming, expensive. Certain situations call for different study designs. But every major health insurance company, Medicare and Medicaid too, has spent billions on superutilizers. In the absence of the most rigorous evidence, how much of this work is built on health policy quicksand?
I can give you an old example of this in medical care.
Duke behavioral scientist Peter Ubel says back in the 80s and 90s, doctors prescribed certain drugs for irregular heartbeats. The medication made those weird rhythms go away, leaving beautiful-looking EKGs.
But no one had tested whether people actually lived longer. And many people thought, why would you do that? We can look at their cardiogram and see that they're getting better. Finally, when somebody put that evidence to the test of a randomized trial, it turned out that these drugs killed people.
Healthcare's littered with these examples, a history Brenner knows well, which is why, when offered a chance to do an RCT of his superutilizer work in Camden, he jumped. Starting this month,
bueno, ¿qué te trae al hospital esta vez?
Brenner's staff has begun going to city hospitals, like here at Cooper, to recruit the 800 patients needed for the trial. As it gets underway, Brenner's decision raises a question. Why aren't more healthcare luminaries putting their brilliance to the test? A couple of reasons. One, Brenner says when you've got a brand like his, he's on magazine covers, works the speaking circuit, gets grants, you don't have to.
There's a long-standing trend in healthcare to use clout and professional status. It's really easy for me at this point, having gotten a MacArthur Award, to simply declare that what we do works and to drive this work forward.
Simply, Brenner says in medicine, it can pay to be opaque. But Duke's Peter Ubel says it's too easy and, frankly, wrong to say the main reason doctors avoid these rigorous studies is because they're afraid to lose money and status. He says it's because even docs, who sometimes see themselves as scientists, can fall into the very human trap, being sure their own ideas are right.
Everything you see is filtered through your hopes, your expectations, and your pre-existing beliefs. And that's why I might look at a grilled cheese sandwich and see a grilled cheese sandwich, and you might see an image of Jesus.
Even with all these hurdles, MIT economist Amy Finkelstein, who's running the RCT with Brenner, sees changes coming.
Providers have a lot more incentive now than they used to. They have much more skin in the game.
She says hospital readmission penalties and new ways to pay doctors bring market incentives that have long been missing. Back on the road, Brenner understands the truth of what he's doing in Camden may be messier than the myth. But he says he can live with that.
I think a lot of people are afraid to be wrong. It's kind of fun to be wrong, because being wrong frees you up from things that are not true and lets you move on to figuring out what's true.
If his brand does take a hit, it means more time at work, more time to figure out what works. And Brenner says he's willing to go wherever that takes him. For The Pulse, I'm Dan Gorenstein.
For millions of Americans, this time of year means one thing. Oh, runny nose, red eyes, it's allergy season. So a lot of people rely on antihistamines and decongestants, but some people have been seeking salvation with a natural alternative.
Every flower in Fairmount Park, every weed, every dandelion, they'll be out and collect the nectar.
Local honey has been gaining a lot of traction among the region's allergy sufferers, but does it work? The Pulse's Alana Gordon looked at the research behind this popular remedy.
Grace Kennedy is staring at a shelf of honey inside the Reading Terminal Market. The jars glow in sunlight from a nearby window.
I'm looking at some wildflower honey, and they're all raw and untreated, completely natural.
And they're local. Kennedy says that detail, honey made from bees in this region, drew her to the stand. She's looking for allergy relief.
They're terrible. Itchy eyes, sneezing, my lymph nodes swell up, runny nose. But if I'm just eating honey almost every day, then it's usually pretty fine.
Kennedy is not the only one seeking out local honey for allergies.
How comfortable are you with bees?
We'll find out.
Okay. If a bee starts running, like, you know, bouncing into your face, then you may want to take a walk.
Don Shump is a web developer turned beekeeper. He walks me to a mid-sized crate, maybe 1.5 feet long and deep, and lowers my microphone into the opening. Inside is a newly arrived colony of 20,000 or so bees. Shump runs the Philadelphia Bee Company. He says people with allergies have been flocking to him like bees to this hive. They're his main source of business. So he set up hives throughout the city and markets the honey by location.
You know, I get people responding all the time when they hear, you know, oh, you're an urban beekeeper. It's like, oh, do you make local honey? And it's like, yes. And it's like, that's good for allergies, isn't it? And, you know, my response is, you know, I'm torn between telling them, yes, absolutely. And, well, technically speaking, we're not really sure.
So is it any good for allergies?
The truth is, if you look through the literature, there is not a lot of credible published information that it actually works for anything.
T.V. Rajan teaches pathology at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine. About 10 years ago, he sought an answer to the honey allergy question. He says the theory is based on a concept called oral tolerization. Think of it this way. Your immune system is an attack dog.
A very, very violent and very effective attack dog.
Its mission is to defend your body, but you still have to train it to recognize friends and relatives. Rajan says allergies occur when the immune system, that attack dog, overreacts. It thinks pollen is an enemy when it's really not. So the idea is if you ingest honey containing traces of local pollen from bees, you can train your immune system to recognize those allergens as friends instead. Rajan put this theory to the test in a 2-year randomized controlled study. It was small, about 3 dozen participants. The results?
That it clearly does not work for adults.
Rajan says he still gets a lot of calls about this decade-old study, partly because there's just not a lot of research out there. Dr. John Cohn runs a busy allergy practice and is professor of medicine at Thomas Jefferson University.
If you're happy, I'm happy. It's relatively harmless if you're not allergic to it. It's certainly there are many things people have done that are much more dangerous ways to treat themselves.
Cohn says the honey concept also falls short because bees probably don't bring enough of common spring allergens, like grass and trees, into the honey. And even if they did, the levels probably wouldn't be very high. But his main concern is if people do have bad allergies and then still skip effective, proven drug treatments that could really help them. Back at Reading Terminal Market, Grace Kennedy stares at the shelf of honey for a few minutes. She finally picks a jar and heads to the checkout counter.
Looks really good.
Kennedy acknowledges there may not be scientific backing to the honey theory.
Partly maybe it's psychosomatic, but I really do think that it helps.
Local beekeeper Don Shump says if she is looking for that hyper-local honey made from bees in her neighborhood, she's out of luck right now. His honeys often sell out long before spring allergy season. It'll take at least a few more weeks before this year's bees will have any new batches ready. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Okay, just walk. There you go.
Got a bee following me?
She broke off. I think I got her attention again.
Okay.
Sweet old honeybee, baby man, sweet old me. Sweeter than a honey.
Measles has been making a comeback. So far this year, 129 Americans have fallen ill with the disease, and we also heard about whooping cough and mumps outbreaks. Many epidemiologists and public health officials are blaming parents who've chosen not to vaccinate their children for personal reasons. Kristen Feimster is an infectious diseases physician and researcher at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and she believes that vaccines should not be optional. Here's her take.
It's time to eliminate personal belief exemptions to childhood vaccines. Vaccines work by protecting individuals from diseases that once threatened the fabric of our society. Think whooping cough, measles, diphtheria, and polio. But vaccine strength really lies in their ability to protect our neighbors. Because when there aren't enough people in a community who are immunized, we are all at risk. We live in a society where we cherish our right to inform ourselves and make our own decisions about how we live our lives and what we put in our bodies. And in recent years, more and more people have flexed that right, citing personal and religious beliefs as their reason to not vaccinate their children. This has to end. We ask our fellow citizens to follow traffic laws, submit to drug tests at work, and pay their taxes. These activities may go against our beliefs and make us bristle, but we ascribe to them because without this shared responsibility, civil society doesn't work. Public health is no different. Not to mention that some people, whether because of age or compromised immune systems, cannot receive vaccines. They depend on those around them to be protected. Of course, to require this of families, we must ensure that the rewards of being vaccinated trump the risks. And they do. Vaccines are safe and effective. The significant reduction in illness and death from vaccine-preventable diseases is testimony to how well they work. Yet, ironically, this success likely contributes to the reason requests for personal belief exemptions have proliferated. Parents of 1-2% of kindergartners in the United States have chosen a non-medical exemption to one or more vaccines. Non-medical exemption rates are as high as 1 in 25 kindergartners in 11 states. Without a doubt, the scientific and public health communities are responsible for ensuring vaccine safety, listening to the public's concerns, and providing accurate and clear information. But our most important charge is to ensure the health of the communities in which we all live. Recent outbreaks of diseases like measles, mumps, and whooping cough throughout the United States have painfully illustrated the key role vaccines play in keeping our families and our neighbors healthy. Sometimes we have to do something we don't fully subscribe to for the greater good of our society.
Kristen Feemster is a pediatric infectious diseases physician and researcher at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Do you agree with her take on vaccines? Disagree? Let us know at The Pulse at whyy.org. And coming up on The Pulse, an old-fashioned science toy makes a digital comeback.
So there we put the potassium in, and here we put the chlorine in, and then you break the beaker.
And you'll never guess where it's become an overnight sensation. Still to come right here on WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new health care law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. With modern medicine, death can become a confusing concept for patients' families. How can a person be dead when they are still breathing, albeit helped by machines? A Philadelphia doctor is training young physicians to be better communicators around this difficult issue. Pulse contributor Avia Mitra has this story.
Hi, Mr. Smith. I'm Dr. Goldberg.
This is Dr. Amy Goldberg. She's the chief of trauma surgery as well as the residency director for general surgery at Temple University Hospital.
I'm the trauma surgeon that saw your son Joe, when he came into our emergency room.
Imagine for a second if this was happening to you.
Well, your son Joe was in a car accident. It was actually a very bad car accident.
How would you process this information?
He was not breathing on his own, and we found that he had a devastating spinal cord injury that has no, unfortunately, brain function. And I'm sorry to tell you that your son is brain dead.
So this is a simulation, but what would you do if you were told your loved one was brain dead? As surreal as this may sound, these kind of conversations happen every day, particularly here in Philadelphia.
Unfortunately, here at Temple University Hospital, we see a significant number of patients who have sustained penetrating injuries such as gunshot wounds. And there is, you know, probably nothing as sad as telling a mother that her 18-year-old son is dead or brain dead.
We all know how difficult this news would be to hear, but we often forget just how difficult this news would be to say. Here's surgical resident Dr. Jay Rajan, who's training under Dr. Goldberg at Temple.
I remember my intern year was I was on call Christmas Eve actually with Dr. Goldberg, and everyone who was senior to me, was, you know, busy with other patients, and they had family members, a person who came in and died in the trauma bay, and they needed someone to go and talk to them about it, and they were getting belligerent. It, you know, in the end, there was no one else around, so I went down and I talked to them, and as you can imagine, there's a lot of, you know, worry that you say the wrong thing, and, you know, you're also worried about how the families will react.
What's surprising is that despite seemingly endless years of medical training, there's very little time devoted to teaching students and residents how to understand brain death, let alone how to communicate these concepts to patients in a compassionate way.
In medical school, we had one afternoon just going through and talking to families and giving them bad news. That's about the closest we got to any kind of discussion of brain death versus death.
Dr. Goldberg noticed that this lack of exposure was affecting her residents as well as her patients, so she decided to institute a training program.
We started our very first program back in 2006. What we do is the residents are actually given the opportunity to role play a difficult situation, whether it's a patient involved in a devastating car accident or a gunshot wound, using the checklist of things to do and things not to do.
It's a 12-point checklist, and it reminds doctors to do things such as ask the family member what their understanding of the situation is first, or explain what tests have been done, or show empathy, and declare a time of death. In the heat of the moment, having a mental checklist goes a long way. And the residents also learned how to better understand brain death from a clinical perspective.
And I think that was important.
Here's Dr. J. Rajan again.
You know, when we came, when I came as an intern and we had this lecture, it was like the first time that these concepts were really kind of discussed and defined in a way that, you know, now I can truly understand what the differences are.
So what are those differences? What does it mean to be brain dead? To understand that, we have to start with another term that's thrown around a lot, coma. A coma is a state of unconsciousness or unresponsiveness. People in comas may have lost higher brain functions, such as the ability to be aware, but their most primitive reflexes remain intact.
So you may not be responsive, but you may gag or cough when something is placed in your throat, or your pupils may respond.
This is not the case with brain death.
Now, when you're brain dead, you lose all of your higher functioning, but also lose those basic reflexes that are controlled at the brainstem level.
Those basic reflexes include things like the corneal reflex, where a scratch to the eye elicits a blink, or the eerily titled doll's eye reflex. Normally, your gaze tends to stay locked on a point when you turn your head. You can try it yourself. Even if you try to let your gaze follow your head, you'll notice it jumps from point to point. In brain-dead patients, that reflex is lost, and their gaze moves wherever their head moves. So by testing these most primitive reflexes, doctors are essentially pinging the deepest parts of the human brain and listening for a response. And in brain death, even those deepest parts of the brain have shut off. In addition, doctors perform a nuclear medicine study that measures blood flow to the brain.
When you are unresponsive or in coma and you lose those brainstem reflexes and you have no blood flow to your brain, then that is when we declare patients brain dead.
Brainstem function is crucial to life in a very immediate way, so brain dead patients are without a doubt dead. The only reason their body is still pink is because a machine is artificially breathing for them. IV fluids are preventing the body from dehydrating, and antibiotics may be preventing bacteria from infecting the body.
But the one thing is that is really very clear and sometimes very difficult for the families to appreciate is that brain dead is dead.
So in a way, the only reason brain death exists is because modern medicine has allowed us to catch death so early that we can temporarily suspend the moment that the brain has died, but the body has not yet gotten the message. Increasing families' comfort and understanding during such a trying time is a feat in itself. But there's another very important aspect to Dr. Goldberg's training program.
When we look at organ donation in brain-dead patients, the huge limiter in families giving consent is this conversation. And that's why we think it's incredibly important. We know from data and literature that patients' families regret not having this opportunity. But if they're told that from such tragedy that their loved one has gone on to save, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 people by the gift of a kidney or a liver or a lung or a heart, you can only imagine how wonderful that makes them feel.
The program statistics are telling. Before the training, 53% of residents believed that brain death equaled death, and only 31% felt comfortable discussing brain death with families. After training, those numbers jumped to 93% and 98%, respectively.
But really, you know, those are numbers, but when you drill down, you're talking about patients and people and families, and that's what it's all about.
For The Pulse, I'm Avir Mitra.
This issue certainly strikes a chord with medical ethicist Art Kaplan, who is often asked to weigh in when national debates rage over a patient on life support or when family members are at war over what is the right thing to do. Kaplan wishes he could eliminate the term brain dead altogether.
Brain death is death, and I wish I could get doctors to stop telling patients that someone is brain dead. What I want them to say is someone is dead. You know, no one comes out and says your relative is cardiopulmonary dead. They say they're dead. And if you want to know why, it's because their heart and lungs have stopped forever working. Brain death should never be used with patients. It should be death. And the discussion about when to stop machines isn't an option. It should become when, not whether. Some of these cases we've seen in the news where families are sort of saying, I want to pray for a miracle or I want to deliver a fetus or other things, those situations shouldn't even come up as options because the doctor should be saying, I'm really sorry, your loved one is dead. We're going to stop, but we're going to give you some time with them before we do, but that's going to be 6 hours or a day or 2 days, but that's it.
Art Kaplan is a medical ethicist at NYU. Victoria Winslow, better known as the Black Madam, will stand trial next week on charges that one woman died and another came close to dying after silicone was illegally but voluntarily injected into their buttocks. The Philadelphia case has garnered international attention and has shed light on an underground and dangerous practice that's cropped up around the country in the name of beauty. Aaron Moselle reports.
They're called pumping parties. Women who want rounder and fuller posteriors pay to have silicone or another substance injected into their behinds. Typically, a party's host who has no medical training injects partygoers at these unadvertised events. Temple sociology professor Julia Erickson says pumping parties simply illustrate today's attitude towards body enhancement.
We live in a world that believes in plastic bodies, you know, that we our bodies are what we make of them. And so I think that that's a lot of what's going on here, is that young women feel that they can have a certain kind of body, and furthermore, they should have a certain kind of body.
As for the focus on bigger butts, Erickson says, like many body image trends, a lot of it is media-driven.
Everybody, including me, has seen the images of Kim Kardashian, and they've seen those images of women with these zoftig figures, and that's become a very fashionable way to be.
Going to pumping parties instead of a plastic surgeon is likely a matter of cost, says Penn Medicine plastic surgeon Dr. Joseph Cerletti. But he warns that lower costs come with a number of very serious health risks. For starters, Cerletti says, the procedure is often performed in non-sterile environments and without medical consultations.
Silicone can migrate. It can get infected. Some of the terrible outcomes have been where the injectable material has been injected directly into the bloodstream, which then causes clot or death or sudden death.
Cerletti says buttock enhancement is not a common procedure for the city's plastic surgeons. When it is done, the patient's own fat is typically injected. Winslow's case involves two known incidents where women suffered severe complications after being injected with silicone in Philadelphia. In 2011, a 20-year-old hip-hop dancer from England died just days after Winslow allegedly injected her inside a hotel. After her injection, she complained of chest pains and difficulty breathing. A year later, an exotic dancer ended up in the hospital after allegedly attending one of Winslow's pumping parties. She survived after spending more than a week in the hospital. She still struggles to breathe at times after doctors discovered silicone particles in her lungs, according to court testimony. Winslow was arrested at a 2012 pumping party in Germantown seconds before the injections started. A source inside alerted a police surveillance team stationed outside. Winslow is charged with third-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, conspiracy, and unauthorized practice of medicine. If convicted, she could face a lengthy prison sentence, up to 88 years behind bars. For The Pulse, I'm Aaron Mozell.
Our next story has the following ingredients: a science nonprofit, an iPad app, and an international mystery. Zach Seward explains.
The Chemical Heritage Foundation wanted to capture the magic of the mid-century chemistry set and bottle it under the smooth glass and brushed aluminum of the Apple iPad. Think of the app as a gamified homage aimed at today's tech-obsessed teens.
We knew that a digital product would not have the same tactile nature, things blowing up on screen. We've all seen that a million times. It doesn't have the same immediacy.
Shelley Gear headed up the project to build the app. It's called ChemCrafter. It came out about a month ago, and it's basically a bunch of retro-looking vials on a screen. You drag and drop the chemicals into a beaker, you mix them up, and you watch the screen to see what happens.
Our thinking was that chemistry sets were so much fun for folks back in the day when you could mix things together and blow things up and create stink bombs and all sorts of fun things. But over time, the equipment as well as the chemicals that were put into the sets became
super lame. Super safe, that is. But when they took out the crazy stuff, kids got less interested. Times change. But the Chemical Heritage Foundation has continued to carry the torch for the once-beloved chemistry set. And the people there are big believers that many top scientists were inspired by the hissing concoctions they made in childhood basements and garages. Gear says the goal with the iPad app was to capture a degree of that excitement.
The digital environment is not as exciting as the real environment, but maybe if you do this here, you'll go into your chemistry class in 11th grade a little more curious, a little more interested to see what you can do, as opposed to, ugh, I have to take chemistry, it's going to be hard, it's going to be boring.
So the app was released on April 6th with little fanfare, and the expectation was a few thousand downloads. Then something strange happened.
We noticed in the first week that our numbers were really high, which was very exciting for us. And then we started digging in the numbers and discovered that, in fact, the vast majority of downloads were coming out of Russia.
As of press time, the app has 209,000 downloads. Gear says 70% of those are from iPad users in Russia. The second biggest market is Ukraine.
We have 8 pages of reviews in Cyrillic.
А так задумка просто супер. Меня как химика даже легко затянуло.
Lots of 5 stars. So I have to assume those are good comments.
Пробирку натрия в воду, smiley face.
One person did a 7-minute video on how to play the game in Russian.
Сегодня мы обозрим программу Чем. Crafter.
So why is an educational gaming app from a Philadelphia science nonprofit a runaway hit in the former Soviet Union? Shelley Gear did some digging on the internet and talked with a few acquaintances from Russia.
And discovered that in Russia, they start taking chemistry somewhere between the 6th grade and the 8th grade, and they take about 4 years of chemistry. The college-bound kids are taking 4 years of chemistry right at the time of their life when we're targeting this app to them.
And that's not all. The founder of Blue Cadet, the Philly-based web firm that actually made the app, says it's not unusual for iPad apps to be big hits in Russia. ChemCrafter is no Angry Birds, but still, for a chemistry set app to take off like this, it caught them by surprise. Blue Cadet dug into the analytics and found that Russians really were using it, not just downloading it and letting it gather dust. The Chemical Heritage Foundation says it might add a few more experiment booklets to the app, given the interest it has unexpectedly found in ChemCrafter. U.S. downloads are still just a sliver of the Russian ones, but as of this week, downloads in Thailand are suddenly bubbling up. For The Pulse, I'm Zach Seward.
Do you want to play with this ChemSet app? I kind of do. We've posted a link at whyy.org/thepulse. Coming up on the show, Black Women in White. Philly nursing school alums talk about starting their careers during segregation.
They didn't want to accept the fact that you were on the same level and you had the experience that many of them didn't have, but they would try to break it.
That's next on The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. The University of Pennsylvania is gathering artifacts and stories from a Philadelphia hospital that closed 3 decades ago. Tanya English spoke with some nurses who trained there and went on to help integrate healthcare in Philadelphia even before federal law began to force change.
In the late 1950s, when other institutions denied care to African Americans or shunted them to segregated wards, Mercy Douglas Hospital was open for business. Black doctors founded the West Philadelphia Hospital and added a nursing school. Today, the Mercy Douglas nurses are in their 70s and 80s. Elizabeth Keys Williams made her way to Philly as a teenager when she couldn't get into nursing school in Harrisburg.
There was another white student and I, her name was Marilyn. She wanted to be a nurse and I wanted to be a nurse. And the counselor who was advising our class had given her all kinds of information in different hospitals to apply to. And she said, let me go to Mr. So-and-so. I don't want to say his name. She said, go to him, he'll help you. And I went to him. He said, I don't know where I would tell you to go.
The 17-year-old tried to enroll at a Harrisburg nursing school. Anyway,
I asked them for an application. No, they let me know they didn't have any black students.
In Philadelphia, some schools were opening their doors to African Americans, but not very wide. Dolores Johnson Brewer wanted to attend the nursing school at Episcopal or maybe Pennsylvania Hospital, but those programs only made room for 2 black students. Brewer says the school told her, try again next year.
Well, that was the ways of the world. You just accepted it.
The world was separate for almost everything, where you ate, where you lived, where you learned. Brewer was in the class of 1952. She and other Mercy Douglas nurses gathered at an alumni tea recently to remember their time as students in Philadelphia.
So we were carefree, because sometimes if you didn't do what you're supposed to do, we would be campus bound, and we would go up on the 3rd floor and jump double dutch. And you could hear throughout the whole building.
They stayed busy with classes, training, and mandatory study hall every night until 9 o'clock. Elizabeth Williams was in the class of 1954. She says the girls were supposed to be in by 10, but someone was always willing to break the curfew or duck the house mother to grab some ice cream or a smoke.
And Mrs. Randall was a big lady. She would put her hands on her hips. I smell smoke up here in this hall. And we would all be scurrying like little mice.
The woman did find time for fun, but Williams says her parents didn't really send her all the way to Philadelphia to play around. Her father was a chauffeur. Her mother worked as a cook.
She wanted something different from me. I think it cost us like $450 for the 3 years that I went there. And believe it or not, that was a challenge too for my parents to get that money together.
At Mercy Douglas, William says she learned to do things the right way and to look like a proper nurse. Every nursing school had its own signature cap and cape. William says the Mercy Douglas look was sophisticated and no nonsense.
Can you just imagine a white dress and your white shoes and your cap, and in here you come with this blue cape, and it's just flying in the wind. And we used to wear this to go over to the hospital. When you put your cape on, you just felt like, oh, I've really got it made.
After earning her diploma, Williams left Philadelphia, and she became the first black nurse to work at Harrisburg State Hospital.
Oh, boy. We had these huge wards with people who were really emotionally disturbed. It was pretty scary had you not had the proper training to figure out what you were going into, because the nurse's station was like a cage itself. You locked yourself in there and did what you had to do, and patients were all milling around.
Williams says her colleagues often showed her kindness, but the hospital policies weren't so fair. At that time, it was the convention that a black nurse could not supervise a white nurse, no matter who had the most training or seniority.
Well, if you were in meetings about certain really problem patients, and I might have the best knowledge about that, that physician's going to ask the white nurse before he talks to me. The doctors, some of them, not all, they would not recognize you. If they didn't have to talk to you, they wouldn't.
Even harder, maybe, was the treatment from aides and assistants at the hospital.
And it was not only some of the whites who were discriminatory against you, it was many of the blacks. They did not give me the same respect they would give the white nurse. You know, it was disheartening.
Times changed, but those slights continued for years. And William says her proper uniform wasn't much of a cloak.
I definitely remember this gentleman coming in, and he walked up to me and he said, "I'd like to speak to the nurse." And I said, "You're speaking to the nurse." "No, I want to speak to the nurse." And I'm standing there, white cap, uniform, and I had a pin on it. It said, "E. Williams, R.N." Didn't make any difference. He did not talk to me. He walked away.
In 1964, the Civil Rights Act forced fair practices in hiring. A year later, the Medicare and Medicaid programs pushed hospitals to accept black patients or give up funding from the federal government. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
And we have photos from the recent Mercy Douglas alumni tea, and we also have a few historical photos of the nurses on our website at whyy.org/thepulse. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joe Patterson, our associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, you can subscribe to our podcast at whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.